as we heard, there are people in Sweden who support Israel and have a deep sense of the injustice of the present situation. It's these people who give hope to those who still believe that things will get better here. One of them is Barbara Spector, a former American who made Aliyah and then, 10 years ago, with the help of the government of Sweden, set up a non-denominational institute of Jewish learning with the Greek name of Paideia, here in Stockholm. She believes the current wave of anti-Semitism in Sweden will pass, and that Jews have an important role to play in a country undergoing profound change.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
Published in the New York World, February 17, 1921, Mr. Henry Ford put the case for the Protocols of Zion tersely and convincingly. He said, quote, "The only statement I care to make about the protocols is they fit in with what's going on. They're 16 years old and they have fitted the world situation up to this time. They fit it now," unquote. He made this statement when Jewish leaders and the Jewish press in America were fulminating against a series of articles printed in Ford's newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, during the years 1920 to 1922. After some years of pressure, such as only organized Jewry can conceive or inflict, Henry Ford was made to apologize in a letter addressed to Louis Marshall, then leader of the American Jewish Committee, dated June 30, 1927. Ford's apology was abject, but neither then nor since did he ever deny the truth of the articles. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. On this show, we're going to be picking up one of the hottest potatoes that you can pick up in today's political and cultural climate. We're going to be talking about Henry Ford's series of books that came from these articles in the Dearborn Independent. They're best known as The International Jew. I think that right off the bat, we need to define some terms here so that we don't get bogged down in terminology. When we say, or when I say during this show, Jews this or that, what I'm talking about is not just your average Jewish guy on the street. What we're talking about is international Jews or international Jewry. And I think the best way to explain this will be with an excerpt from the first volume of The International Jew, from the first chapter, The Jew and Character in Business, where Henry Ford says this: "It would be very simple to answer that the Jews came to America, took their chances like other people, and proved more successful in the competitive struggle. But that would not include all the facts. And before a more adequate answer can be given, two points should be made clear. The first is this: all Jews are not rich controllers of wealth. There are poor Jews aplenty, though most of them, even in their poverty, are their own masters. While it may be true that the chief financial controllers of the country are Jews, it is not true that every Jew is one of the financial controllers of the country. The classes must be kept distinct for a reason, which will appear when the methods of the rich Jews and the methods of the poor Jews to gain power are differentiated. Secondly, the fact of Jewish solidarity renders it difficult to measure Gentile and Jewish achievements by the same standard. When a great block of wealth in America was made possible by the lavish use of another block of wealth from across the seas, that is to say, when certain Jewish immigrants came to the United States with the financial backing of European Jewry behind them, it would be unfair to explain that rise of that class of immigration by the same rules which account for the rise of, say, the Germans or the Poles, who came here with no resource but their ambition and strength. To be sure, many individual Jews come in that way too, with no dependents but themselves, but it would not be true to say that massive control of affairs, which is exercised by Jewish wealth, was won by individual initiative. It was, rather, the extension of financial control across the sea. Now, with that introduction behind us, I want to say right off the bat that my personal views and anything that I say on this show do not necessarily represent the views of my co-host Ghost or of HiddenMysteries.com or TGS Publishing. And with all that said, tell us, Ghost, why you felt that it was important to publish these books.
Well, I am 100% the free speech, free press adherent. I am a true conservative when it comes to constitutional rights. And this book has been suppressed, and especially the series of books have been suppressed for far too long. Because Henry Ford is one of my favorite characters of history. He's a true conservative in the business, financial, mercantile, and trade type concepts. You can find probably no one more conservative than he was. But at the same time, he was a realist while being conservative. And the man lived through three major depressions in the United States. So he knows what he's talking about. He did his studies. He had the money before the third one hit to actually research and find out where the problems were being caused at. And that's why the book is important. It's important to Jew and Gentile alike.
Just to get us started here, what do you think, just in your own personal opinion or speculation, how much of the book do you think is fair? How much of it do you think is accurate? And how much of it do you think that Ford got wrong? And the stuff that he got wrong, do you think that he got it wrong because he was anti-Semitic?
Well, put numbers to what you're asking, because it's not a book. We're talking about four books just on one subject, and that subject is divided into subtopics, so you can't really give it a number like you're asking for. But he had at least 80% of his facts right. Some of the facts have changed, and he admitted that as he went along too. But his facts are the facts, regardless of the way he could saw the conclusion of those facts. Some of his conclusions were his opinions or him connecting dots that should not have been connected, possibly. But his facts remain the facts, and what he uncovered was very, very truthful.
Well, you know, one of the problems with connecting the dots and, you know, putting all the facts together in a proper way is that there is so much disagreement and obfuscation that goes on about these things that from one person to the next that you speak to, you it's really hard to even get an agreement on what Jews or Jewry is. Now you and I know that they're simultaneously they're an ethnic group and that Judaism is a religion and all, but there's a lot of confusion about that. Would you like to address that?
Well, I can give my historical research into it.
Okay.
The word Jew is not really Jew. A J is a recent addition to the English alphabet. It was U. It's always been U, as in Yiddish. And the Roman state of Iuda, Judea, was the beginning of the word Jew. It didn't start with King James or the Torah. It started with Rome. Rome had created a state which included many I say many, several other kingdoms that combined into one Roman state called Judea. Judea became the Jew. The anti-Semitism, if you trace back history far enough, and there's an author named Alexander Delmar, which we sell his books on Hidden Mysteries also, he uncovered the fact that that's where the first hint of anti-Semitism ever was found in print. And it came from the Caesars. And the Caesars had a bone to pick with the Jewish people, the Jewish nation at that time, of the state, because they were able to buy their goods and merchandise through India and avoid going through Caesar's mercantile system. Therefore, he started a campaign against them for cheating, basically as an anti-patriotism act, accusing them of, because they were able to buy their goods and services from a different source. And, you know, it's an age-old problem that that we've discussed probably for 2,000 years in the Christian side of this thing, and it's not going away. It's not going away anytime soon.
Okay, and what Ford was doing, would you agree, was that he was addressing this problem by attempting to expose the facts in as non-biased a manner as possible?
Yes, he gave it a very honest, unbiased attempt at it. Yes, he did. Because he was basically attacking or showing the financial and banking entanglements of international Jewry to the in the media side of the international Jewry, and how they connected, how they were interwoven, and who controls what. And he's not alone in this period of time of people saying this. Even Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, admitted that this was a problem in his office, was having them on his tail all the time about something. You had the editor of the Times of London retire early, quit his job, and wrote a massive tome on the same thing, how they had taken over the Times of London, and he had no more say-so in what went on. If it had anything that was considered anti-Jewish, they were not allowed to print it. So it's a matter of control from a certain segment of the international Jewry that these people were exposing what's going on.
Well, in volume one, Ford points out that as what was going on at the time, and it still goes on every day, was that there was no group. I'm getting as close to quoting him as I can here, straight from memory. It's not an exact quote. He said, "There's no group, no ethnic or racial group, that benefits so much from so much daily favorable press as the Jews, and this can only be attained or achieved by owning the apparatuses necessary to produce this favorable press." And there, you know, there was an article in the Times of Israel a few months back that, of course, when there was a big outcry, they took it down, but it's been archived all over the internet, and the title of it was "Jews Do Control the Media," and it gave a big breakdown and showed that they control 96% of global media. Now, you can't turn on a single network broadcast or cable network news program or news channel and watch it for very long before you have guests on there promoting Zionism, denouncing anyone who disagrees with anything that Jewish foundations and organizations are promoting as anti-Semitic. It really has become, in my opinion, anti-Semitism once meant a person who hates Jews, and now it has really been watered down to the point where anti-Semitism really doesn't mean anything more today than you are a person who disagrees with something that one of these representatives of international Jewry says.
Well, I've been on the whipping end of the ADL before, or actually the Southern Poverty Law Center, which is one and the same, basically, being accused of things that aren't me. They never questioned me. They never talked to me. They never asked anything from me to come up with their opinion. They based it all upon their own belief system not a bit of facts were involved, and put it out as though it's the truth. And now everybody respects the Southern Poverty Law Center as having the gospel truth on who's a terrorist and who's not, or who's a racist and who's not. And they're just making the stuff up as they go. Well, you got proof of it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But, you know, that in recent weeks, a lot of that has changed. The FBI announced a few weeks back that they will no longer be using the Southern Poverty Law Center as a resource for terrorism and hate groups and so forth, for very reasons that you list. And they also came out last week and they attacked Dr. Ben Carson, who I'm sure all of our listeners know who he is. He's an African-American surgeon who has become something of a political figure recently, that a lot of people want him to run in the Republican primaries next time. They attacked him, you know, basically called him a racist and saying that he wanted to set things back for blacks and Jews and all that. And they had their facts 100% wrong. And I'm no supporter of Dr. Carson. I think, you know, he seems like a fine man and all, but I disagree with him just about 100% of the time on political and societal issues. But they actually had to come out this week and apologize to him. And their site is so inflammatory that there are videos that you can go and watch on YouTube of interrogations of serial killers. There was one serial killer who he went out killing people who were listed as hate groups or hate mongers on the SPLC website, and they will never even acknowledge these things. And they came after you because of your involvement with Republic of Texas. Is that correct?
That's correct. But there's no greater hate mongering group than the SPLC.
I agree. You know, anyone who has any ideas about that states' rights or nationalism of any kind, or just basically anything that disagrees with the established order that we have in the West, especially in the United States, or anyone who opposes, you know, just basically writing a blank check to Israel, they're labeled as anti-Semites, white supremacists, and, you know, just any kind of a hate group that you can imagine. If you really want to, you know, perform an exercise in absurdity, I'd go to the SPLC website, go to any page or any article that they have about anybody, and, you know, open another tab and start fact-checking what they put on there. I mean, if I were to start a website and just pick out people that I don't like and start accusing them of all the worst things that I could possibly think of, knowing that most of it's not true, you'd basically have my version of the SPLC website. And these are very influential groups. And it's not just the SPLC. You've got the ADL, AIPAC, and just legions of other alphabet soup organizations that are all in the business of influencing American policy and American culture. And, you know, that all goes back to the protocols that Henry Ford talked about extensively in his books. And I wanted to get your opinion on this because, you know, we've talked about this before. You sell the book, The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, and by Victor Marsden. And, you know, a lot of people say that a whole lot of the stuff in the book is anti-Semitic and it's made up and all that, but the protocols themselves, you know, the numbered protocols, they're what's really important, don't you think? And do you agree with Henry Ford that they fit with what has been going on and they fit with what is happening today?
Well, yeah, those protocols are definitely being used. They were being used when they were written. They've been being used thousands of years before they were written down, as far as a document called the protocols. The problem with the protocols themselves, that in the book that originally released the information on them, was the author, Victor Marsden, who threw in every nasty opinion he could ever come up with about the Jewish race that had nothing to do with the protocols themselves. He was his opinion, he was the one that actually ruined the concept of making them look, giving them some veracity as being real by the nonsense he put in with the book. The protocols are the protocols. Somebody wrote them down years ago, and they're no different than Mein Kampf or Mao Zedong's Red Book. It's a list of things to do to control a certain group or people or set a goal. There's nothing evil necessarily about them other than the people using them.
And they really are, in effect, if you look in the protocols, they're listed out in a manner to where anyone with the financial and political resources and the organization behind them to pull them off, they systematically go through every aspect of a society and show how to take it over, mostly through subversion. I mean, you've got the financial sector, you've got control of media, control of education, control of civic organizations, subversion of religions, and they're just, it really is in a small number. How many protocols are there? 27, 28?
Yeah, it's just a handful.
Yeah, and in those protocols, I mean, it really is, the efficiency of it, if you study just the protocols themselves, the efficiency of it is just almost chilling. There is nothing left out. And we really have seen this. You know, it's been going on in Europe for longer than here, but a good, honest, and factual look at American history, especially beginning at the turn of the 20th century, and you can see where they began attempting to institute the protocols prior to World War II with limited success, and after World War II it really took off. What do you think the reason for that is?
I think the powers, in this case particularly the Allied powers, had nothing to go with other than those protocols. They hadn't planned on anything, but they wanted total control of the European front. And England and the United States controlled the front and actually froze Russia and them out, other than the few Eastern Bloc nations they got away with. But inside Russia, even, they used the protocols. Stalin used them continually. He may not have had the list called the protocols, but he used the same rules that are in there.
Well, the protocols, as they're written in the book, and from when the book came out, the protocols were written specifically to institute the Bolshevik revolution, the takeover of Germany, the elimination of the Tsar and his family.
Well, that's what Marsden said. I don't know that that's true.
Well, it worked out that way.
Well, they might have used them, but say we're going back to Marsden's opinions and not sticking with the facts.
Yeah.
And I don't care about Marsden's opinions.
Okay.
You know, for me, I mean, to me, he was just an idiot.
Okay. Well, let me run a couple of things past you here.
I sell his book because I do think everybody should read him. They just shouldn't believe him all the time.
Yeah. Well, so you think the only thing in the book that really is valid is the protocols themselves?
Well, if I could define the word valid, it's just a set of rules.
Yeah.
I mean, they're valid because they're being used. Well, they were being used then, or they probably wouldn't have been written down.
Yeah. Well,
Hitler used them. The United States is using them.
Sure.
England's using them. Israel's using them. CIA uses them.
Okay. Well, let's just get down to the brass tacks of it. Who, more than any other group, controls international finance?
There's no question on that. International Jews do control international finance and commerce, not just finance. They've got the total control of the commerce too.
Yeah, and I think it's important to point out, as we're saying this, that in the United States, Jews account for just barely over 2% of the population. Globally, they account for 0.2% of the population. And yet, they have managed to really have just a stranglehold on international finance. And that's one of the things that makes it, you know, it's almost like a Gordian knot to try to unravel. Because, you know, as we're sitting here talking about the international finance end of it, then you look at, you know, who's the main player, the name that everybody knows. Well, you know, just pick Goldman Sachs. you cannot find a candidate from either party who, you know, running for major office like senator, president, that sort of thing, who doesn't get a huge chunk of donations from Goldman Sachs. And not only the donations, but almost 100% of the time, either the candidate himself or a close family member has been an executive with Goldman Sachs. Ted Cruz is a good example. He's the big golden boy of the Republican Party and the Tea Party right now, despite the fact that he's not eligible constitutionally to run for president. There's a huge grassroots movement to get him to run for president. His wife was a vice president with Goldman Sachs. He still gets his health insurance through Goldman Sachs. And as I said, there's very few candidates that you can look at. And that's the Gordian knot that I'm talking about. They control the international finance. They admit themselves that they own 96% of global media. And you have all these politicians who are beholden, I mean, just to that one international finance company, you know. I mean,
it's when we all jumped in there with $800 billion to hand them over free of charge to bail out their crimes.
Of course. I mean, and that's, isn't that a wonderful system that they've got? They, you know, they gamble with their own money. When they lose, we bail them out. After we bail them out, they keep the profits. The losses are public losses. The profits are private profits.
It's an interesting scenario, but you're right. And it's not just in the United States. This is going on in Canada. It's going on in Europe, going on in England, and it's going on in Australia, as bad as it is here.
Well, one of the things that Ford highlights throughout the books is that so much of this has to do with the cohesiveness of Jews as a culture or a race, however you want to look at it. And there are lots of theories, many of them, you know, highly researched by people like Kevin MacDonald and others, that Jewish cohesiveness, what do you think it comes from? One of the biggest theories is that ever since they were expelled from Jerusalem and the last diaspora occurred, that they have had to live as outsiders in other countries, and that their exclusiveness in you know, having to have their own little sector, you know, for instance, there were lots of there were things like in most European countries, the Europeans themselves, usury was outlawed, but it was okay for the Jews when they'd come in, so they would get into that, and they would get into other things. What do you think, and we're not trying to nail down facts, we're asking questions and just trying to come up with some ideas here. What do you think accounts for this Jewish cohesiveness over the centuries, indeed over the millennia?
Well, I think you go back to more of the fact they've got one religion, not thousands upon thousands of Christian religions. They've got one religion. You know, there's a few little stray marks on them, but basically it's one religion for one type of people, for one race, for one family, for one tribe, however you want to look at it. And they stuck with that tradition and that culture century after century after century, and the culture remains a cohesive culture due to that. We don't have that in the Gentile sector, especially in Christianity, where we have one church since the Catholic Church got split up back in the Middle Ages. So we've lost the cohesiveness we once had through the church itself that the Jews retain. That's why Muslims, like, they're so strong. You know, they're only competing with two different major factors there, factions. They basically have stayed the same for millennia, and they're a very cohesive group, and one speaks war, they all speak war. That's basically the way they march. And you got to give credit to where it's due. It's not because they've planned it that way. It's just the way it's happened.
All right. Well, at this point, we're going to take our first commercial break. We'll be right back after these messages.
Truth seekers and freedom-loving Texans. HiddenMysteries.com is the place to find those hard-to-locate books for your research. HiddenMysteries.com has the largest and most diverse knowledge-based selection on the Internet today. Be sure and visit HiddenMysteries.org for over 12,000 free articles for truth seekers. Visit HiddenMysteries.com today or call 903-876-3256 for a free catalog.
We're back. We're going to start this segment off with a quote from Charles Lindbergh. He says, "The Jews are one of the principal forces attempting to lead the U.S. into the war. The Jews' greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership and influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government. I am saying that the leaders of the Jewish race wish to involve us in the war for reasons that are not American." It's Charles Lindbergh, September 11th, 1941. Now, precisely 3 months from then, the United States declared war on Germany. 4 days prior to that, they had declared war on Japan. Do you think that there's any validity to Lindbergh's statement that it was the Jews who were trying to lead us into World War II?
Well, when you talk about the international Jews, there's no doubt about it. And if you don't, we haven't told the folks yet. I had a mentor for years named Rabbi Gilner. I studied with him. I learned all about Judaism and how it works, or what he was told me. Taught me the Torah. There was no finer man on earth than Rabbi Gilner, and he agrees with a lot of this stuff we're talking about tonight. And he knew it because he worked for Henry Kissinger and hated him at the same time.
Well, go ahead.
I'm gonna say, you can see what's going on in Israel today to see that they're pulling the same stunt right now in our Congress in Washington, D.C., as what you described happened in 1941. They're using undue influence. They're using foreign money, using American money that they give them and come back and use it against us to push their point across and force the lobbies, using the lobbies to force their opinions on Congress. And of course, you got 535 bribe takers up there that are hands out all the time for it.
Well, and it's not just our money that they're using. They're using the blood of our children, because, you know, one of the really popular memes out there is a picture of Uncle Sam, and it says, "Join the army and fight wars for Israel." You know, I don't think that...
Well, it's supposed to be a joke. It's really not funny because it's a fact.
It's absolutely a fact. I don't think that anyone who can take an unbiased look at what's going on, at the wars that we fought and so forth, that they can say anything but that the wars that we have fought in the Middle East over the last, 15 years, and of course many more than that, but specifically since the 9/11 incident, that these wars have been proxy wars for Israel. I mean, it's a whole systematic thing. You take out Saddam Hussein, and then the next thing you know, they want you to get Assad, and then the next thing you know, they want you to nuke Iran, and they're just constantly agitating for these things. They have kept us wrapped up in the Middle East all this time, and I don't see it as being in anyone's interest other than Israel, international bankers, and the international corporations.
You go back to George Bush Sr. when he's war on Panama, because Noriega nationalized the banks, and he jumped and followed suit what the commanding international jury told him, is go get our banks back.
Well, and when he... Yeah, and an interesting point about that is that it was the Bank of Panama was the most well-known and most used safe haven for money that had been laundered by these international financial institutions for drug lords. And it could easily be said that Bush was going after to get back the drug money for the banks, and much of it is own.
Well, there's no doubt they're in control of manipulating opinions around the world. You know, there's nothing more illegal than a self-made vigilante group going around trying to arrest Nazi war criminals without any justification, without any jurisdiction, without any authority. That's been going on for 50, 60 years. Give it up. You know, it's time to get back to law. And if you're standing in law, they're standing alone.
All right. Well, let's talk about the churches and Jewry. Here's a little bit from the book. The last place the uninstructed observer would look for traces of Jewish influence is in the Christian church. Yet if he fails to look there, he will miss much. If the libraries of our theological seminaries were equipped with complete files of Jewish literary effort during recent decades, and if the theological students were required to read these Jewish utterances, there would be less silly talk and fewer easy marks for Jewish propaganda in the American pulpit. For the next 25 years, every theological seminary should support a chair for the study of modern Jewish influence and the protocols. The fiction that the Jews are an Old Testament people faithful to the Mosaic law would then be exploded, and timid Christians would no longer superstitiously hesitate to speak the truth about them because of that sadly misinterpreted text, quote, "I will bless them that bless thee and curse him that curseth thee." Now, this is Ford, I don't think, could have possibly known how often that verse was going to be used in the decades after his death. I heard Abe Foxman of the ADL make that exact quote on Fox News a couple of weeks ago, and he followed it up with that anyone who opposes Israel's interests was opposing the interests of God because they were against his chosen people. Now, what do you think of the chosen people ideology?
Well, I want to start with what you said a while ago about Henry Ford talking about the churches, and he was a prophet when he said that one, because it wasn't but a year later after his passing that Billy Sunday was given the floor of Congress for a sermon to convince Congress to vote in the Israeli nation at the UN. And that's the only reason they exist, because of a Christian preacher.
Right. And we can't really go into this subject and ignore the Schofield reference notes. And now you talk to your mentor, the rabbi. You discussed the Schofield reference notes with him, didn't you?
Yeah, he said that they were, a lot of those were Jewish influence. Well, they were written by Jews. He wasn't sure because, you know, it had been edited so many times, they couldn't tell what was going on anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, Schofield reference notes, of course they were written by Schofield himself, but the majority of what is in the notes now, they've been edited many, many times since his death, and many of the edits give no citation, you know, no attribution to the editor. And those Schofield reference notes are where a lot of strange non-biblical ideas came out. You know, things like the rapture. You know, a lot of your more fundamentalist, even the mainstream Protestant churches, they really hammer this rapture into the heads of the people in their churches. And I think a lot of what's behind that is, if you believe that this rapture is coming to take you away before all the tribulation happens, it really takes a load off your shoulders of having to say, okay, I have to look at the facts, I have to inform myself, and whatever it is that's going on in the world that is causing the problems in the world, I have to oppose it. Well, if you believe, as the Schofield reference notes has taught us, not only the rapture, but that these things are all God's plan and that they need to be actively brought about, that the temple in Jerusalem has to be rebuilt, that they have to tear down that mosque and rebuild the temple on the Temple Mount so that Christ will come back and save you from the tribulation and, you know, and all that sort of thing. It's really a it truly is a, you know, regardless of what you may or may not think about Christianity or Christian ideology, this really is a subversion of Christian doctrine, isn't it?
Well, it's a subversion of the normal Christian doctrine as of starting in the 1800s, but I can't see that we can blame Judaism or the International Jewry for it.
Right.
I mean, I see a lot of what you call illiterate preachers, for a better word, because I've hold my tongue back, of interpreting the text of the scripture, and they have no education at all. They have no foundation in ancient Greek or any Hebrew behind them. They just read something that King James said you should read and go with it. You know, that's the blind leading the blind. What are we paying them for? We're paying them to, you know, supposedly they pay these preachers to know something so they can teach you, and we're not getting it.
Well,
so that's more of the problem with, like they say, the Scofield. That's not just them. It's a lot of Christian Bible notes.
Well,
you know, even King James refused to use the one that was in print, the English one that was already in print, because he didn't want those notes there that condemned his lifestyle.
Yeah.
He's a pedophile.
Right. Well, you know, it's not just the Scofield reference notes, though. There are so many avenues that where Jewish influence comes into the Christian church. And I think one of the ones that
most of the influence into the Christian church probably comes from a group, whether it's organized or unorganized, called Jews for Jesus.
That's who I was just about to bring up.
Mainstream Orthodoxy doesn't even bother with Christianity. I mean, they could care less.
Well, you know, in my lifetime, I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, and in my lifetime, I saw a real sea change in that topic. I remember when I was very young, you would hear pastors giving sermons on the fact that, you know, the Jews were no longer the chosen people, that had been transferred to the Christian church and so forth. And at some point in my teens,
that's hockey poo too.
Well, okay, but it's whether or not it's hockey poo, this is what was taught. Now, at some point in my early teens, and this would have been in the early 80s, you know, to date myself there, this completely changed, and the Jews for Jesus started showing up to the churches very often, passing around the plate, wanting money for Israel. And, you know, any type of criticism, it was very strange. All the criticism of other religions, and I'm not saying that was a good thing, but that was really one of the main things in all the churches that I went to. When you go to Bible study on Monday night, or when you go to church on Sunday night, there would be lots of criticism of other Christian sects and other religions and that sort of thing, as a, you know, a way of proving we're right, you're wrong, that sort of thing. Judaism was never mentioned again, and the attacks always were aimed at other Christian sects.
Sometimes it's what they don't say. They said that is mind controlling through the media and whatever. I can remember just a few years ago when John Hagee, mouthpiece out of San Antonio, claims he's a Christian preacher, which he's a Christian talker, was expounding on the benefits and the wisdom of being 100% for Israel. A few years ago, he was writing books against them, but for that, but he was expounding on it. But you could turn the news channel, which I did as quickly as I could, because I cannot stand the fat jerk talking. Anyway, I turned it over to the news. There you got Israel bombing, firing on the Church of Bethlehem.
Well, sure.
This doesn't make sense. We're supposed to support this.
Well, yeah, and one of the things, especially, you know, if you're active on social media or you go into the comment sections on news websites and stuff, one of the things that you'll really find that it's just almost a monolithic opinion block is fundamentalist and mainstream Christians in their support of Israel, and their bloodthirst to see the Palestinians destroyed. And one thing that never seems to get pointed out at all, and if it is just really quickly in passing, is that there is a percentage of the Palestinians, not only throughout Israel, but especially right there in Gaza, who are Christian. And not only are they Christian, They're the original Christians. They're right there in the Holy Land, and they're the descendants of the members of the original Christian church from nearly 2,000 years ago. And it's a real moral and theological blind spot for these American Christians. And what they're doing in Gaza, I don't see any word that fits better than Holocaust. I mean, it's exactly what they've got. They have a final solution for the Palestinians, and they are enacting it. Am I overboard saying that?
No, because they've already found out, more or less proven, that Mossad, the international Jewry, who controls most of the Israeli government also, is behind the stirring up of the nonsense in the Middle East from nations that have lived together for millennia together and never had a war between each other.
Well, sure.
Syria's got some of the oldest churches in the world being destroyed because of the manipulation of the Mossad.
Well, you know, the French press exposed nearly a year ago that the leader of ISIS is a British-born Jew who is a Mossad operative. Then they have pictures of him side by side, one in his house in Tel Aviv with his wife sitting on the couch, and one in his Muslim garb with his beard grown out. It's obviously the same person. And it's the guy, when the beheading started, when they beheaded the first American journalist, he was the man standing there with his knife to the guy's throat. Mossad appears to be the innovators supreme of the false flag. And you know, this stuff's been going on forever. You can look back to the Book of Ruth. I mean, that, you know, it's the whole story of setting your enemies against one another through false provocation. There are lots of theories that Mossad had a lot to do with 9/11, and it's an established fact that when the planes hit the towers, there were Mossad agents with a van with high-dollar camera equipment on top of the van pointed at the buildings, and when the planes hit, they started celebrating, and witnesses who saw it called the NYPD, and the NYPD rushed and, you know, arrested them. They ended up arresting over 100 Mossad operatives, and they held them for a few months and then just quietly sent them all back to Israel. You know, and
go back one administration before that under Clinton. We all heard about the guy at Los Alamos that was sneaking our technical secrets out to China because he was a Chinese man that was doing it. And we heard about it. And for months you heard about the thing, but no, you never did hear the resolution. Whatever happened to this trial? Well, it got down to trial, and they finally discovered that, yeah, he was exporting them to China's Mossad.
Yep.
So it would go straight back to Israel. They are the biggest spies in the United States today, and every Israeli spy should be hung, quartered and hung, be honest.
Well, absolutely. Well, every spy should.
Every spy.
But, you know,
ours over there, too.
Yeah. Well, I suppose
if we have a spy in Israel, hang that son of a bitch.
Right. Well, you know, there's also they've been behind spying for the longest in the United States. And, you know, if you go back to the 50s, the McCarthy hearings, you know, McCarthy really got smeared by the media. And still, you know, the term McCarthyism still has a horribly negative connotation today. But as the classified files have been declassified over the last 10, 20 years, it turns out that McCarthy was just absolutely correct almost 100% of the time. One of the biggest examples was Alger Hiss, who was chief of staff and personal advisor to FDR. You know, he was an American Jew, and he was a communist working for... I mean, he was an inter...
That may have been, but that was not illegal.
No, I'm not saying it was illegal.
So
but I'm saying,
why to bring it up?
Well, these things...
He's a stupid congressman.
But who, Hiss?
No.
Oh, McCarthy?
McCarthy.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is that, like, FDR was surrounded.
It was not illegal to belong to the Communist Party any more than it was not illegal to become a Baptist.
But it was illegal to be a Soviet operative, which Hiss was.
Well, Hiss, but that's only one. All those right. people he condemned were not guilty.
Right.
The ones you don't hear about are the ones that suffered.
Yeah.
Well, under his lies.
Well, I mean, you know, who are we talking about? Screenwriters?
Screenwriters, actors. I mean, he went after people that had no clue what he was talking about.
Well, that's true, but I'm focusing on the spying aspect of the thing.
And he had the spies down pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And what about...
The problem was, his idea was bring in the whole herd, let's find the one spy.
Well, that, yeah, and there was a lot of political grandstanding to it. But the thing is,
he liked his picture on TV.
Well, yeah, not only not you know that too, but when you discount,
go about France as a newspaper or brought up the subject. You know, did he ever mention that about the French-born Jew that's the French president?
You talking about Sarkozy?
Yes.
Yeah, he's not.
No, the next one.
Oh,
following him.
Yeah. Well, no, it didn't. But.
Well, he's the one when the stuff erupted. And
you're talking about Hollande.
Yeah. He ran over to Netanyahu and said, please bend over. I need to kiss it.
Yeah.
Please bend over.
Well, you know, that's one of the, you know, you bring up France. You know, we had the terror attack a few weeks back that has come to be known as the Charlie Hebdo attack. And Charlie Hebdo, of course, was a Jewish Frenchman who ran a magazine called Charlie Hebdo, and it was very outspoken and had a big reputation that they constantly attacked Christianity and Islam. And so, you know, he's become kind of a poster child for free speech, but I don't think it's really factual to hold him up as that, because if there was one thing you were not allowed to do at Charlie Hebdo, that was to criticize Jews. For one thing, Hebdo, one of his writers was a 70-something-year-old French journalist, had a very good reputation. Hebdo had him prosecuted, fired him and had him prosecuted because he wrote an article about Sarkozy's son, you know, not converting because... I guess necessarily be the word, but, you know, taking on Judaism as his religion for financial reasons. And, you know, it was a fairly even-handed article. Sarkozy told him to, you know, retract it. He refused to retract it. And, you know, he had him prosecuted under the hate crime laws in France. And they have a lot of that stuff going on there. They have a famous comedian over there right now who is being hounded and prosecuted because he questioned the numbers of the Holocaust. And you know, there are a lot of famous...
Even my rabbi questioned the numbers of the Holocaust.
Sure. Well, I mean,
I said it right. Holy cost.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of people refer to it as the Holo hoax because there's so much grifting.
That actually came from a Jewish author.
Did it?
Oh yes.
Well, was it Finkelstein?
That was him.
Okay. Yeah. He has a really good take on that stuff. You know, it, and that's one of the things I was getting at when I asked you earlier, you know, what changed pre and post World War II that gave international Jewry so much control in the United States. Billy Sunday, but the Holocaust propaganda is a huge part of it.
That was all planned, and the rabbi showed me the letter from another Jew to another Jew about how they were planning all that.
Well, and yeah, and the number 6 million, when it comes to Jews, they've thrown that number around for the longest. I have
about 6,000 years.
Yeah, well, I have a graphic that we'll post either in the article or in the comments section under the show here. That it has the New York Times, and it takes all the stories that they had starting just before the turn of the 20th century and going all the way up, you know, before the 1930s. I mean, there were dozens of articles decrying the 6 million in Russia that we have to save, the 6 million here, the 6 million there. What do you think the deal with the 6 million number is?
According to Rabbi, that was a historic number. It's supposed to be the number of Israelis that crossed the Jordan to create Israel the first time. They started off with about 600,000 when they left Egypt, grew to 40 years to 6 million. I mean, if you can't work and you can't farm and you can't raise your, you know, what else you got to do but go to bed?
Yeah.
So it grew to 6 million, according to the story behind it. But it wouldn't matter. If Hitler killed one, or not himself, but one of his guys, killed one illegally, it's a Holocaust.
According to who?
Me.
Oh, I...
It's a Holocaust of anybody. It's a Holocaust what they did to people here down here at Waco.
Right, I agree.
They, one was made it a Holocaust.
Well, what do you think about what the...
I mean, the murder of men, women, and children, and we're condemning Hitler?
Well, what do you think? What about this proposition? The Treaty of Versailles basically handed Germany over to international Jewry, and, you know, finance, government, and all that.
I don't know that it actually worded handed it over, but they did take advantage of it.
Yeah, well, they had complete control of the banking system, the money supply.
That's because they wouldn't allow the Germans to have it back.
Right. And you had Germans starving to death. You had mothers and daughters being forced to become prostitutes, and the fathers being forced to become pimps just so that they could eat and survive. You had over 270,000 German men asphyxiating themselves to death every year. And you had a system where a loaf of bread could cost billions of Deutschmarks. The inflation was so horrible that when a German worker would get his pay, he would run however many blocks it was to the butcher or the baker, because between the time that he was handed his pay and the few minutes that it would take to get to the butcher or the baker, the prices would have risen.
That shows you that not all the Jewish bankers are that smart.
Well,
that's the same thing that they're doing in the United States right now.
Yeah,
and we can say they're not that smart because they're going to crash their own systems.
Well, see, now that's where I agree with you that it ends up crashing, but I'm not certain that I agree with you that it's them not being so smart, because, you know, is one of the main things that
it's greed. It's what they think that what we can grow now and do it grow fast, screw the rest of the world later.
Well,
it wouldn't be able to view Jew or Gentile. That's what these bankers are doing.
Well, think of this now. One of the things that Ron Paul really woke up a huge chunk of the American population to in his 2008 campaign was the inflation tax. Is a coin that term that he coined. What the inflation tax is the inflation happens because the fiat money supply is expanded. And let's just say, to keep it simple, you had $1 million in circulation and everybody had their own little nest egg, and it was had X amount of spending value. Well, the Federal Reserve comes in, they say we need more money in the supply, and so they pump it up from $1 million to $2 million. Well, what they've just done is they've taken the money in your banking account, your retirement account, your savings, whatever it is, and they have halved your spending abilities, but they didn't give you an extra dollar for every dollar that they print. You know, they printed for every dollar's worth of spending value that you lost. They didn't give you another dollar. They kept that dollar themselves. So what they did was they just stole half of your ability to spend and consume and took it for themselves. And they don't just sit on that money. They take that fiat money that they create, they take your spending value that they create, and they turn it into real assets. They buy land, they buy businesses, they buy precious metals, and so on. And so, you know, they invest in oil and energy. And the end game of this, if you carry it out to its logical conclusion under the you know, within the framework that I've laid out here, the end game is that once you've taken as much as you can of the spending value of the people who actually do the work and create the value, once the system implodes, you have turned all of that into real assets, and now you have everything, and the producers, or the milk cows, as many of them refer to us, have nothing.
Well, that's the same thing that you talked about a while ago, that Lindbergh said. It's the same thing that was said in 1913. It's the same thing that was said in 1933. Same thing Ron Paul said, and nothing's going to get changed. It's not. They're not going to stop it. You've got the people on the take up there that's not going to stop it. I mean, everybody complains about the 1913 law. Even back then, they were complaining about, why didn't they just abolish it? Oh, they wouldn't dare upset their Jewish masters.
And that's exactly what they are, aren't they?
Well, they are our masters when they control our money.
Well, they control our money. They control our media. They control our education system.
They control the money. They got you.
Absolutely.
And look at the rest of it's neither here nor there. We can turn the TV off.
Well, that's true, but you can't
turn the money off.
Right. But, you know, the media control thing goes back to what we were talking about just a minute ago.
Today's money is media. It's nothing but printed paper.
Sure it is.
It's not really money.
No.
But you go back to international affairs. We left out Ukraine a while ago.
Right.
When a Jewish reporter was down there reporting on the chaos in the early part of this disruption down there, and John McCain was there, he says, wait a minute, those guys over there are Jewish. I know them. They're Mossad. And they were the ones stirring up the trouble against the main government. So Israel's up there in Ukraine stirring up the stuff to draw the United States into another battle, into another war that we have no business in. It's not even our part of the world.
Well,
you can't use the Monroe Doctrine for the whole universe.
Well, an interesting aspect about the whole Ukrainian thing is that, you know, what you've got going over there in reference to international Jewry and Israel as well, you know, for the longest there has been what's known as the Khazarian theory, that the Ashkenazi Jews are not descendants of any of the tribes of Israel or, you know, the ancient Hebrews, that what they are, and Benjamin Friedman was one of the first people that I ever heard expound on this, that what they were is, you know, a northeastern European people who had been pagans, you know, some type of phallus worshipers, and that they converted, and, you know, at the upon the decree of their king, they converted, that he looked at the world's three major religions of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, and he chose Judaism because he felt that it would provide them with the most cohesive culture and be the most advantageous to them, and that those were the Jews. And in modern history, that has been one of the, you know, really controversial points, because Jews have really struck back at that and say, you know, it's not true. We're the tribes of Israel. We're the people in the Bible, etc. Well, now that they've got the thing in Ukraine stirred up, it is the Jews, specifically Israel, who have...
It's not the Jews in Ukraine. It's the Jews from Israel.
From Israel.
Stirring stuff up. Yeah, it's Israelis.
Exactly. And international Jewry.
Israelis and Jews.
And it's not just Israel. It's also the international Jewry.
The banksters.
The bankers, yeah. Now they've revived the Khazar theory. They're saying that it's correct, and therefore they have a claim on Ukraine, and that oil is theirs.
That's why they're so mad at Iran, because they want to stop Iran's move to have an international oil, what do they call it, Borsk, something like that. Anyway, it's another international window to buy oil from them that goes around the United States and goes around the international bankers.
You're talking about BRICS.
No, he didn't call it that at the time, but I don't. That may be what it is now, but I just remember the little short guy. I can't remember his name. Abadabjad.
Oh, you're talking about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad.
Yeah. he was talking about it, and this is what brings up the idea that they're the enemy because they wanted to do something on their own.
Yeah.
Well, if you do something outside the wishes of the banksters in that one square mile called the City of London, then this is what happens to your nation. And this is what's got to be arrested and stopped if we're ever going to see any solution to this mess.
Well, now, and you know, before we leave the subject of Ukraine, you know, it's really interesting that the nationalists that are trying to, they call them nationalists, the ones who are trying to maintain control over all of Ukraine, and, you know, that are being opposed by the Donbass separatists who have Russia as an ally and all that. They're actually, you know, they're the ones that the media is referring to as Nazis and this and that, and they're the ones who are supported by international Jewry, financed by them, and, you know, most of the bureaucratic positions are staffed by them. There are several leading rabbis from Israel who are there, you know, stirring the pot right now, and they're establishing a new central bank, just like our Federal Reserve, and all the rumor mills are saying that the person at the top of the list to head that central bank is George Soros.
What a mistake.
Well, I agree.
I'd give him Murdoch. At least it's a cleaner ripoff.
Well, yeah. But I think that this will be a good spot to take our last commercial break. And we'll be right back after these messages from our sponsor.
Are you an unpublished author? You can get your manuscript published at incredibly low prices. TGS Publishing is the largest print-on-demand publisher in Texas. Visit tgspublishing.com for more details. Order as few as 50 copies of your book and keep your capital for marketing. TGS Publishers can get your literary work into print and published. tgspublishing.com.
All right, we're about to wrap up this show for tonight. I know it's run long, and I want to let you know we have only been able to just lightly touch on a few of the topics that are covered in the International Jew and that are germane to the topic of international Jewry, Jewish supremacy, and the influence of Israel and that sort of thing. And in future shows, we're going to narrow down and focus on particular aspects of these topics. Ghost, I asked you earlier, and we got kind of sidetracked. Tell us your take on the chosen people doctrine.
Yeah, I got a couple of takes here. Rabbi Gilner, who was my mentor, once said, "It ain't all it's cracked up to be. You're much better off not being the chosen. Because if you go by that chosen race theory, you're cursed. And you live under those curses." That was his take on it. But there's been a chosen race, chosen people, since the days of Atlantis. The people that escaped Atlantis were called the chosen people. They were probably the ones chosen to escape the sinking or something. They were a tall white race, and they were in. They entered from Atlantis by boat, hit France, and that was one of the chosen races. Are the Hebrews the same? I don't know. We keep talking about the Jewish question, and the Promised Land was given to the chosen race. But are the Jews the Hebrews? Are they part of the Hebrews? Nobody ever talks about the Hebrews who were actually delivered the promise. Because they all want to say the word Jew. And I've confronted several Jews and asked if they're Hebrew, and they had to admit, no, we're not. They're not Hebrew. And the Promised Land is that piece of desert rock, not even the size of New Jersey, that's stirring up so much trouble in the world? I think not. Because if you go back to your Bible, the chosen race, and that Promised Land was given over to Caleb, not to Joshua or the Israeli people or the Israeli nation at that time. So you've got two theological questions there that need to be solved. before you can actually define what this chosen race was or is. I don't believe there is a chosen race. If they're chosen, you know, if you're born in Texas, you're probably a part of their chosen race, because I feel like I've been chosen and lucky to live in Texas. So you can have a chosen race or people anywhere at any time as far as the perception of the people. To the Jewish people, they probably consider themselves a chosen people, chosen race, based on the words of their holy scriptures.
Well, now you touched on people from survivors of Atlantis having been chosen people. Do you have any books in stock on that people could learn about that?
Oh, I do, but I'd have to look it up and find the quote on it, or which book it was in.
Well, we'll probably, at some point after this show is posted, we'll probably...
We need to do a show on Atlantis.
We will. And we'll find one of those books and you know, post it under the show as well, if anyone's interested in that. What about the Palestinians? Could they be considered a chosen people?
Well, they were the offspring of Abraham, so how could they not be in that theory?
They are sons of Abraham, then.
Yes. Of course, anybody that was the sons of Eber are actually Hebrew.
Now, explain sons of Eber.
Sons of Eber. Eber is the same word as Hebrew. That was Abraham's father. You know, they came from the Ur of Chaldees. They didn't come from the Ur of Chaldees in the Mesopotamia. They came from the Ur of Chaldees in India. There's a lot we can go on this subject for another two or three shows, but not all that they're taught in Judaism or in Christianity is what the study school teachers are too illiterate to find out the truth. And I was lucky to have a rabbi that pointed this out, that Abraham is not a Sumerian name. Abram is not a Sumerian name. It was an Indian name.
Well, yeah, and like you said, that could be a show in the future. You know, it's not just the ancient Hebrews of the Old Testament. There are lots of theories that at some point in his adult life, Jesus of Nazareth went to India and studied with the yogis there.
That or his twin brother Thomas.
Well,
that's another show.
So just to kind of wind this up, I think, you know, a few of the things that we pointed out here. The world as the average couch potato who's planted in front of the TV watching Fox News and CNN and MSNBC, the world that they understand from the information that comes from there and comes from the mainstream newspapers and so forth, it's really an Alice in Wonderland thing, because the people that they think are in control really are not.
They need to consider themselves brainwashed, mind-controlled, manipulated into decisions not benefiting their best interests.
As Charles Lindbergh said.
Exactly.
All right, so as we... Now,
my rabbi had a definition for the Knesset and the Israeli government. He called it the Hasatan. In Judaism, they don't think of Satan as a person. It could be a group of people. But anyway, the Hasatan meant the Satan. And he considered the Knesset Hasatan, the father of all the lies.
Well, there are large factions of Orthodox Jewry who completely oppose Israel and, you know, their plans for the inhabitants of Israel and the world, really. Isn't that correct?
Oh, that's true. Most of your super ultra Orthodox are Torah only type Jewish theologies do not believe in this Knesset. It should be there at all, because, you know, Israel is supposed to have been put together into a nation by the hand of God, not by the hand of the UN and Billy Sunday. Therefore, they're worshiping the wrong land that wasn't created for them, if there was one to be created for them. You know, and the Christians need to understand that if you go to Israel and you speak Jesus' name or try to tell somebody about Christianity, you're going to be arrested and put in jail. It is just that simple. They do not have freedom or democracy in Israel. Don't let them fool you, because they have anything but.
Well, I think that's a good place for us to stop tonight. The show has run extra long, And as I said, we were barely able to even touch 1% of what we'd like to talk about, and there will be future shows on the subject. I'd like to invite everyone to go to HiddenMysteries.com, check out the selection of books. And is there anything else you'd like to plug tonight, Ghost?
Next year, Jerusalem. Shalom.
With that, we're out. Good night. Good luck.